Welcome to Alden Pod. I'm your host, Emerson Green. Say that determinism turns out to be true. Everything can, in principle, be explained, and everything has a sufficient reason for being as it is and not otherwise. Every event in consciousness and the physical world is determined by the concatenation of antecedent events, conditions, and laws of nature. And let's make things even worse. Say that everyone is a product of blind luck. Luck swallows everything, as Galen Strawson puts it. Everyone is just lucky or unlucky to be who they are, to be in the circumstances in which they find themselves, to have the desires they have, the willpower they possess, the values they hold, and so on. Is it true that such a world would preclude the existence of free will, or at least free will in any meaningful sense of the term? Most philosophers would say no, but if I had to guess, most non-philosophers would probably disagree. The thing is, even given the full brunt of determinism and luck, a lot we care about remains stubbornly in place. For instance, there are still virtuous and non-virtuous people. There's still a moral law that can be followed or broken. There's still suffering and flourishing that can be diminished and maximized. There's still a social contract that can be honored or broken. There are still moral standards by which actions and people can be judged, and we can succeed or fail in living up to those standards. In other words, everything that mattered before still matters, even if determinism is true and luck swallows everything. As J.P. Andrew put it, it would, to my mind, be a bizarre view of moral facts indeed that understood them to hold only if free will is possible. Inflicting suffering for fun is surely wrong, regardless of the capacities we humans do or do not possess. End quote. So what else remains stubbornly in place? Our conscious agency still plays a direct causal role in determining what will happen next. It doesn't follow from determinism that the same future will unfold regardless of what we do. And further, there's still a distinction between voluntary and involuntary action, intentional and unintentional, approval and disapproval of first-order desires, ordinary and extraordinary circumstances, reason responsiveness, and non-reason responsiveness. Even given determinism, that is all still there. For these reasons, we can still have good and evil, love and hate, praise and blame, reward and punishment. Regardless, we don't have what Strawson calls heaven and hell responsibility. Even with libertarian free will, it's not clear that anyone would deserve eternal conscious torment. The supposed consequences of libertarian freedom drawn out by its defenders frequently do not follow from the mere existence of libertarian free will. This is part of why I question whether it matters much if we possess libertarian freedom. For instance, eternal conscious torment or the death penalty are not justified purely in virtue of the existence of libertarian free will. Whether or not libertarian free will obtains in our world is an interesting metaphysical question, but I just don't see how it makes much of a practical difference. Free will skeptics and libertarians seem to me to be entirely wrong about the dramatic consequences that would follow from not possessing libertarian freedom. I think a compatibilist is basically someone who doesn't have a quarrel with using the term free will, and who thinks we don't need to run around with our hair on fire if determinism turns out to be true. Determinism, as I mentioned, doesn't necessarily entail a denial of your agency. Determinists don't all hold that your feeling of agency is just an illusion. Why does it feel like you have some control over what you do? Because you do. Why does it feel like you're choosing what to do and making decisions that determine your behavior? Because you are. Why does it feel like my conscious intention to do X caused my doing X? Because that is really what happened. Again, I don't claim to speak for all determinists, but I believe in mental causation. I think some mental states are causally efficacious. It's up to you, at this moment, to do what you will do next. compatibilists can affirm this. Given everything we've talked about so far, that there are still virtuous and non-virtuous people, still a moral law to be followed or broken, suffering to be diminished, standards by which we can judge actions and people, a distinction between acts performed voluntarily, intentionally, with approval of first-order desires under ordinary conditions, and acts that were not. And given that there is still conscious agency and a will that plays a crucial role in causal history, this is where I turn to free will skeptics and libertarians and ask, what more do you want? Has anything changed? It just seems like everything is still there. But could you have done otherwise? We should pause and remind ourselves what is often, or at least sometimes, meant by free will. Are there actual alternative possibilities open to us? Some have argued that we can't deserve praise and blame, reward and punishment, or be held morally responsible without actual alternative possibilities. Lately, I've been trying to defend a compatibilist notion of could have done otherwise that's rooted in epistemic possibility. Say we do need randomness or indeterminacy in some form for freedom. Well, we can have randomness or indeterminacy in some form. Dice rolls are random, coin flips are random. A Laplacian demon would know the outcome, but it's nonetheless random and indeterminate as far as we're concerned. So epistemic indeterminacy, as I'm calling it, is a kind that's compatible with determinism. There's a deeper sense of indeterminacy in which even a Laplacian demon wouldn't know the outcome, but what I'm arguing is that we don't need that deeper sense. In fact, I think we could just reject the notion of could have done otherwise entirely, but let's just say we want to preserve it in some form. So there are alternative possibilities open to us, just like the coin could have come up heads or it could have come up tails. Whether these alternative possibilities count as actual possibilities, genuine possibilities, is a subtlety I want to explore here. So a roll of a die could have come up 1 through 6, and this is true in some sense even if dice rolling determinism is true, which I'll just assume from here on out. Say that Dan rolled a 6, and consider these two propositions. Proposition 1, Dan could have rolled a 1 instead of a 6. Proposition 2, Dan could have rolled a 0 instead of a 6. So in some sense, both statements are false, but they're clearly not false in the same way. The idea that Dan could have rolled a 1 is at least epistemically possible, but that he could have rolled a 0 is not possible in any sense. So with regards to rolling a 1, things really might have been otherwise. People roll 1s all the time. And prior to rolling the die, we don't know if Dan will roll a 1. But we know that he won't roll a 0. So I think there are plenty of analogies when it comes to epistemic possibility in the realm of human action. Dan might feed the hungry, or he might not. He's done both in the past, as have many others. However, he's never eliminated world hunger, nor could he. Again, he could have rolled a 1 or a 6, but he couldn't have rolled a 0. This distinction comes in handy when we're discussing ought implies can. If determinism is true, then Dan couldn't have rolled a 1 or a 0 in some sense. But we can easily imagine rolling a 1. It's conceivable that he could have rolled a 1. In fact, Dan has rolled a 1 before. But he couldn't have rolled a 0. Likewise, he can't end world hunger, and he's thus not obligated to end world hunger. Ought implies can. But given the opportunity to feed the hungry, he could have taken the opportunity even though he failed this time. In fact, he's taken the opportunity before. Dan is free of the obligation to end world hunger, but he still feels a pang of conscience about failing to feed the hungry when he's given the opportunity. And for some reason, he finds no comfort in the truth of determinism. And I would say he's right. He could have fed the hungry, and he should have. Further, we don't know the future. We're ignorant of what will happen. So since we don't know which outcome will come to pass, and since our conscious agency plays a role in determining what will come to pass, it's unwise to say that epistemic possibility is somehow inauthentic, or doesn't amount to actual or genuine alternate possibility. In some sense, epistemic possibility is all we have. And epistemic possibility runs throughout philosophy. This may cause difficulties for one who arbitrarily decides that epistemic possibility is insufficient for any meaningful alternate possibilities. The fine-tuning argument, to give one example, runs on epistemic possibility. So I think there may be an inconsistency lurking between running the fine-tuning argument and saying that epistemic possibility is not enough for genuine alternate possibilities. And I only use that example because many libertarians are also religious. But epistemic possibility is used all throughout philosophy. Rejecting it in the realm of human behavior is arbitrary. Determinism doesn't take away the power of your will or mean there's no difference between a strong will and a weak will. It just means that your will is one of those dominoes in the causal chain. Determinism doesn't strip you of your agency or mean that the future will unfold regardless of what you will do. That only follows from a naive understanding of determinism. Your agency still makes a difference, but you and your agency come in a context. You're not a causa sui actor who floats free of the causal web. You've only been stripped of freedom of the will in the superlative metaphysical sense, which you couldn't have had anyway, regardless of determinism, dualism, or anything else. So since we don't know which outcome will come to pass, and since our conscious agency plays a role in determining what will come to pass, that means it's profoundly important how we use our conscious agency. Given everything I've said so far, it would seem misleading to say that I don't believe in free will. And yet you could accuse me of revisionism. The concept of free will has been mutilated past the point of recognition. I'm just changing the subject. I would argue that while my compatibilism is, to some extent, a revisionary project, compatibilist notions of freedom are close enough to the original that we're not simply changing the subject. One element has been removed. A non-essential element, but many others remain in place. Anyone concerned with freedom will take note of at least some of the conditions mentioned earlier. Voluntary versus involuntary, intentional versus unintentional, approval versus disapproval of first-order desires, ordinary versus extraordinary circumstances, reason-responsive versus not reason-responsive. We would not describe a person acting involuntarily, unintentionally, and with disapproval of their first-order desires as acting freely. On the other hand, a person who's acting intentionally, voluntarily, with approval of their first-order desires, would rightly be held accountable in a way the first person would not be held accountable. Why? Because they were acting according to their own free will. I used to think compatibilists were redefining terms in a rather annoying way. In fact, you can probably find older episodes of Counter-Apologetics where I say as much. So I lived a few years as a free will skeptic, someone who didn't think we possessed freedom of the will in any meaningful sense. But as I went on listening to the debate between compatibilists like Daniel Dennett and his incompatibilist opponents, I found myself siding with Dennett on nearly every issue of substance. I thought back to the numerous disagreements I'd had with fellow incompatibilists and free will skeptics over praise, blame, and moral judgment. I eventually realized I was already a compatibilist, in all but name. Thank you for listening according to your own free will. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time, because I want to. Thank you.